What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, one of the awful trends in our country are these mass murders taken on by very troubled individuals, generally young white males alone, with their own fantasies and their own debilitating conditions that force them to think that the only way they elevate themselves is by destroying others.
Yeah, I can't understand this, and I don't even know how we can fight this, because it's really it's such a tough problem, and there each one is so different.
But there is a commonality. I mean, look, you and I, when we were here on the air, on radio live during the Sandy Hook shootings, and we know, I mean, it's one of those things you can almost say to yourself, it's generally going to occur generally in a small or rural community.
Right.
It's generally going to be a person alone, acting alone, with a huge cache of weapons. There are certain common characteristics. Now, I will grant you, John, that we don't know enough about them. And boy, I wish we knew enough that if, in fact, they showed signs, which they often do in advance to someone, that we had enough laws on the books that would allow us to talk to these individuals before, if they are showing signs, and perhaps help to stop one of these attacks.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't understand it. We've just come up on the anniversary of the Las Vegas shooting, and here, I mean, I don't know. It just still boggles my brain, you know, how somebody could do what they did.
Well, back in 2014, the FBI initiated a study of these active shooter incidents, and they really wanted to help federal, state, local, campus, law enforcement to get accurate data to better understand how they could prevent or prepare for or respond to. Because in these cases, oftentimes, law enforcement, first responders, really take the brunt of a lot of this. And it's a really difficult situation. And we have seen debates about, should they wait until there are three and then they can go in? Should they go in immediately? There's all kinds of issues related to how law enforcement handles these situations.
Yeah, well, I don't think, you see, I don't even know how you can train for situations like this. I mean,
but they are.
They've got
these active shooter drills all over. I mean, dare I say, in schools today, which is really unsettling.
Yeah, because they seem, at least on the surface, seem so random. You know, they just come out of the blue, and all of a sudden they're shooting people for God only knows what reason.
It's interesting, though, one of the more recent attacks, and again, they begin to blur, unfortunately, because they're so consistent these days. But I had read where there were at least 29 individuals detained because of things that they were posting on the internet or things that they had said to others. Now, again, many of them never would have acted out. But how do you know, and who do you know would or would not?
And now you get into a rights situation.
Of course.
Because, somebody could say, well, I heard Larry say something about this, you know. So are we turning our society into, a military society because someone says something? And I don't know.
Well, you're right. I mean, the liberty versus security. I want to turn now to Catherine Schweit, who with the FBI put together this incredible study of the active shooter problem that we have in America. And it's only gotten worse. But so many of the findings are revealing about the problem that we now face here in our country. A really important issue today on America Trends.
With us on the line on America Trends, we are so thankful that she could join us, Catherine Schweit. were given the task some years back as members of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, better known as the FBI, to initiate a study of active shooter incidents. Now, Catherine, this goes back to 2014. What was the precipitant for it? I mean, was that one event or just the accumulation of activity that seemingly became something of a pattern?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to share what I've learned. But the precipitous event indeed was the Sandy Hook shooting. Prior to that time, I had been working national security cases, domestic terrorism, international terrorism as an agent at the FBI. But then I was asked to join a federal team to see what we could do to prevent these shootings from occurring again.
And at that time, yes, as you're reminding us, our focus was much on foreign terrorism. And that is somewhat receded these days, but the issue of domestic terrorism of the sort that we've seen just in recent weeks clearly is front and center in our minds.
I recognize that a lot of people don't think about domestic terrorism in the way that the rest of us who work these cases do, but domestic terrorism has been around in the United States for a long time. 20 years ago, I was working domestic terrorist cases and putting people in jail. So it's not a new phenomenon. It's perhaps one that has come into more prominence in the news.
What about the notion that we're hearing today of a white supremacist tinge to a lot of this? Is that something that you saw back in 2014, or is this something that's beginning to emerge to a greater extent now?
The active shooter research itself didn't have to do with the ideology of the shooter, but as an agent, I did work domestic terrorist cases 20 years ago that were white supremacist cases. And there's no question that, as the Director Ray said just recently, FBI Director Ray said just recently, there clearly is an uptick in these, and primarily our domestic terrorist cases are, a majority of them are white supremacist related.
What is the definition of a mass shooting? Because I think a lot of us paid a lot of attention over the years to many cases that were well publicized that were serial killers. In this case, we're talking about somebody at one time taking out large numbers of people. So there's a great difference in the methodology, I would imagine, of those who are committing one or another.
You're right. Exactly that difficulty of identifying what kind of crime we're trying to investigate. That was our starting point right after Sandy Hook. First, we had to be sure that we were working with the proper and common definition. So an active shooter is an individual who's engaged or in actively attempting to kill or killing individuals in a crowded area. Now, that's different than what we would consider also about mass killings, right? Because a mass killing could be somebody who's a serial killer. Mm. Or a mass killing could also be somebody who commits a murder-suicide on themselves and their seven family members and in their home. So we didn't want to research at the FBI mass killings as a whole because we know what causes some of those, or we have done a lot, there has been a lot of research on what causes some of those situations. What we did want to do was look for why are these shootings occurring in crowded places, active shooter situations, and I would say this, the reason that we call it an active shooter situation is because both law enforcement and the people who are there actively engaged can both participate in potentially saving lives.
And in many cases, there are people who are not law enforcement who actually intercede, put their own lives on the line, and often, as I'm understanding it, they're not even armed.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's probably one of the more surprising pieces of data that came out of the study that I wrote for the FBI was that of 160 active shooters incidents that we researched, out of 160 of them, 21 of them, or 13%, ended when an unarmed civilian safely and successfully restrained the shooter. That's a lot of incidents. That
means
that
really is.
More than one out of 10 situations, a civilian can make a difference.
One of the other statistics that I have read in the past relates to the fact that domestic violence or family members' involvement in these situations often is the precipitant, or at least the first incident. And then when someone has gone on, for example, in the case of Sandy Hook, which I know a pretty fair amount about, once you've killed your mother, I guess you can do just about anything. And particularly since in that case, his mother seemed to be the only person on earth who really cared about him.
You are correct that about 10% of the cases that we investigated, there was a family member who was killed or wounded prior to the ultimate public slaughter of innocent lives.
The other thing, I did interview Catherine Newman, who wrote the book Rampage, and she said, look, this is not a surprise in the sense that there are many signals that are given out by people that, number one, they're in distress, but number two, that they might plan to put some of their very contorted ideas into action. And we just have to listen much more carefully to hear what they're saying. And in the case of Dayton, we now find that there was someone who actually helped him to get some of the equipment and components that he needed. So people are talking. It's not as if out of the blue these things occur often.
You're right. And I think that people don't always recognize what's happening in front of them. If I had a dime for every time as a prosecutor somebody said to me, he's never done anything like that before, you know, I would be a rich woman. So it isn't about what that person has done in the past. It's about what they might do in the future. Let me tell you something about a research, if this works. I wanted to tell you about some research that just came out. So just last summer, the FBI released the second part of the research that we were doing. The first part was a study of active shooter incidents in the United States between 2000 and 2013. And then in July of last year, the FBI released the second part of it, which was a study of pre-attack behaviors of the same shooters. So that's something that really, I think, is an incredible, wonderful, insightful piece of information to understand who we're talking about. And it really gets to exactly what you just said, that on average, that study found that on average, each person displayed 4 to 5 concerning behaviors, observable concerning behaviors to others. Almost half of the cases were not reported to anybody.
So what do you think is going on there? That it's somebody you love, you think maybe they're having a bad day, you think that they would never act out on their impulses. What is it that you think this tells us?
I think most importantly, it tells us that we are fooling ourselves if we think it's a loner in the basement, person isolated and playing video games or has some big mental health problem. Research so far has shown that none of those are true factors of who you're looking for. You should be thinking about the fact that it's the guy sitting next to you in your cubicle at work. It's the kid who's playing football with you or with your kid. It's the woman in the grocery store in the line. Everybody has stresses in their lives. And the people who commit these crimes, our study showed ages 12 to 88. And in general, we saw a lot of shootings that occurred, of course, almost half of them in the business arena. So we're looking at people who are in their 30s and 40s. Not what sometimes you think of when you think of a school shooter, but more than half of these situations are occurring in the public in an environment that is commercial, in business related. Only a quarter of them happen at schools. So, yes, we know a lot about school shooters. We know that middle school shooters come from the middle school. High school shooters come from the high school they attend. But we also know that if you're in a business and you're in a law office or you're in a packing facility, you're in a closed facility that the public doesn't come to, a mail sorting facility, a shipping facility, a dentist's office where the public doesn't come through, those shooters are also from those facilities generally. So it's more important for you to recognize that the person who you want to help not do this could be standing right around you. And a lot of times we just don't see that.
I would like to separate these for a moment. I think a lot of people think that there are problems with a lot of our young boys, and a lot of them in rural, suburban communities. And I recall that when I did interview the author I mentioned before, Ms. Newman, she was saying that a lot of these incidents occur in suburban or rural communities by what she called failed joiners, meaning people who tried, but they just never fit in. In an urban environment where fewer of these things seem to take place, it's generally because, in her mind, we accept diversity more. But when you're out in a suburban or rural community and different, it really makes it very tough to interact, and therefore a lot of the anger builds up. Do you agree with that?
You know, I haven't seen any research that points to the difference between rural and urban, so I don't want to disagree and be disrespectful, but I don't know the data that supports that. I do think that the data changes through time. Every time we have another incident, we get more information. And I think, you know, if you understand how somebody moves on this pathway to violence, anybody can move on that pathway to violence.
We keep getting more information. Unfortunately, it's because we seem to have greater frequency of these events. Now, when you looked at it between 2000 and 2013, 11.4 incidents, an increase year over year of about 16% a year. Have you tracked it since? I mean, are we going up at a higher rate? It just seems like there's a lot more activity out there more regularly.
The FBI does track these using the same methodology every year. Before I left and after I left, they continue to track using the same methodology. And you can find that research that's up to date on the FBI website. If you do a search bar search for FBI active shooter resources, you'll be able to find it. FBI active shooter resources. You'll come up on the FBI resource page that has the updated data on the individuals and the incidents themselves.
Catherine Schweit, I do want to ask you, because we talked about school shooters, what about the business side of this? Because you tell us that, in fact, more of these occur, more of these active shooter incidents within the context of businesses. I'm just curious, businesses, of course, have many methodologies for screening their employees, watching their behavior, their interactions with employers, with supervisors. So is that a more controllable environment in terms of trying to get our arms around where disgruntlement might come from and where these incidents might occur?
Yes, so I think it's kind of twofold. Businesses that are closed to the public where there isn't pedestrian traffic, that absolutely is an employer workplace situation where it's not something maybe that you're going to screen anybody off in terms of the hiring of them. But I think you need to be aware as an employer about how you take care of your people and how you respond to them, not just about their duties at work, but being attentive if they seem to be stressed out, if they don't get the promotion they want, if you're firing somebody, if you have to let them go, whether it's for cause or not. We see a lot of situations where somebody comes back because they feel they were wronged at work. And that is a situation that is potentially very avoidable. I'm not going to say it's completely avoidable, but the way that you bring somebody down and help them, it helps them to not have a kind of a triggering event, which we see sometimes, where somebody is harboring a grievance, whether if it's at work, for example, and they're frustrated over the promotion they didn't get or the raise they didn't get or the job that keeps getting harder or whatever that might be. And then there might be something that happens that they lose their job. Or it could be something that's completely outside the home, like they have a breakup. They stop seeing somebody at work that they were seeing, and it's embarrassing, and that's a triggering event. So you have to look a little bit more holistically, because it is kind of everybody that's around you. And then if it's a business that's more open to the public, like a mall or one of the bigger box stores, you know, one of the box stores that has a lot of pedestrian traffic, those shooters don't generally have a particular relationship with that location, except for that they know where it is or how to get to it.
What about the randomness that seems to have come into play of late? So we know about the school shootings and the disgruntled employee coming back to a work environment. Now bars, retail, festivals, mm-hmm. It's so unpredictable in many ways, and many call this the soft target aspect to all of this. How difficult does that make it for law enforcement?
It's very hard. As a law enforcement officer, and I've worked in private industry, and soft targets are hard, as you would expect, to protect. A fence doesn't protect somebody. Orange cones that tell somebody not to drive their car there doesn't protect somebody. And the same thing, you want your business to be open to the public, and when it is open to the public, it's as, you know, it's as open as the street in front of your business. And that is just difficult. And again, you, I think you would have to fall back on the fact that this has happened in virtually every state in the union and the District of Columbia, and it is incredibly infrequent. So you cannot have an unrealistic fear that this is going to happen. I see that. I hear that from people saying, I don't want to go to the movies, and I don't want to go to the mall. I don't want my kid to go to school. I can't go to church to worship. And I say that's an unrealistic fear. Given the frequency, you're more likely to die in a car accident or in a plane accident, probably. Not that I have the stats on that.
However, people will say to you, mental health issues abound across the globe. There are many people who are troubled in everyone's midst from every far corner of the world. And yet, it really seems to happen disproportionately in the United States. Now, this is all on the heels of us worried every moment. The same things you just said about someone coming in from out of the country, a jihadist looking to do the same thing in a mass shooting situation or creating terror and havoc wherever they were. So here we are on the heels of that, and now we're refocused on the domestic threat. And America seems to be disproportionate, are we not?
Violence doesn't take a vacation in the United States, and we lead the world in this type of shooting. That's definitely true. I will say something, though, about mental health. You mentioned that, and I know that people, when I look at what causes this, a lot of times people do talk about mental health, but I think that it's important to remember some very, you know, hard, firm information about the mental health statistics. And probably best displayed in just last week, the National Council of Behavioral Health released a study called Mass Violence in America, Causes, mm-hmm. Impacts, and Solutions. And the National Council of Behavioral Health found that mental health is not a factor any more than other things are kind of up. There's kind of an uptick. There's no question that there's a slight increase. The FBI research shows there's a slight increase potential with regard to mental health. But with regard to the mental health itself, the concern about tagging somebody with a mental health, which is really a diagnosis, right? Not somebody mm-hmm. who's stressed and troubled. And I think it's more important that we talk about people who are stressed and people who are troubled, not identifying them as somebody who has a mental health problem. Those are diagnoses. And when we tag everybody who is thinking about, you know, looking for and tag everybody and say, oh, it's a mental health problem, then really what we're doing, and I think that the National Council on Behavioral Health put it well when they said, you know, millions of harmless and nonviolent individuals who are recovering from treatable mental health issues are subjected to that stigma. And we've worked so hard to take that stigma away because people who get mental health care that's exactly what we want people to do who are troubled and are working through issues, and maybe they do need some mental health care. And we put them right back behind a wall when we start tagging everybody and saying, oh, this is only happening because of mental health issues, when we know it's not.
I don't disagree, but that's what a lot of people, many Republicans, say that. Then they say video games and all kinds of other things, and we never really get to the issue of the lethality of the weapons and the ammunition now available to shooters, thus causing more harm more quickly. The Dayton case being one where that magazine carried, I think it was 100 rounds, and he was able to get off 41 shots or more in the course of 30 seconds. What does that say to you?
I think that people misunderstand how fast killing can occur and how many rounds can come out of just even a handgun. There's no question that a rifle that has a 100-round magazine is going to be very lethal. And we've seen some terrible shootings because of that. But we've also seen some terrible shootings because of handguns. So let's not discount that. I mean, a weapon is a tool in this process, and they are used very effectively. Probably only a third of the shootings involve rifles. That's a lot of handguns and a lot of shotguns that are killing people.
Now, we know in 2013, the president at the time, Barack Obama, signed into law the Investigative Assistance for Violent Crimes Act of 2012. We know that the study then ensued, and we know that there are many law enforcement officials who really want to understand this better because there are many casualties and many injuries on the part of law enforcement in trying to put to rest an active shooter situation. Do you think that there are any laws that have not been passed? We're talking now about red flag laws. We're talking about boyfriend laws and such that you think could make a material difference based upon the research.
Well, I think there's a lot brighter than mine in the world of passing laws. I would say this, whether it's a red flag law, whether it's laws that have to do with weapons control or use of firearms, whether it has to do with the age of sales of firearms, or whether it has to do with any of the other many subjects that may come up in terms of background investigations for employment or whatever. All of those are part of a big puzzle board. I mean, that's how I see it. Prevention, response, and recovery are the three components to how we solve and save lives. We have to do better at prevention, which is the ultimate goal, but we also have to do better at response and better at recovery. We've made so much progress in that area, like better law enforcement training, better training for medical personnel. We've made a lot of progress, and those laws are just part of the puzzle pieces that need to be put on the board.
What about the protocol for law enforcement? I had read where at one point you wanted to wait until three individuals were available before you went in to try to quell an active shooter situation. Now I was reading where one can go in alone. What do you think about that, and what is changing in that regard?
Law enforcement response has changed over the years. Initially, there was every law enforcement officer for themselves kind of situation. We eventually learned that SWAT teams and more sophisticated tactical teams were beneficial to us. But as we ebbed forward with a lot more sophisticated tactical teams, like we did around the time of the Columbine shooting 20 years ago, what we saw was that a delay in going inside. And that was criticized and is part of the analysis of how can law enforcement do it better. Law enforcement always does an after action to say, how can we do it better? And because of Columbine and other such incidents, there were these three-member teams. There were different types of training that was designed to say, hey, let's send in a tactical team, but a smaller team that can, as soon as three people show up, they can go in. Some departments train to that. A lot of departments of the United States, particularly on the West Coast, train to that. But other big departments train to the three or more. And what we've said since Sandy Hook is, even if it's one officer, if you're trained properly, one officer needs to go in if they can. I think a law enforcement officer, you know, as a former FBI agent, you know, I've carried a gun and had to make decisions on whether to move with my weapon. And so you can't second guess very quickly another law enforcement officer and what they're hearing and seeing and doing. But what we want a law enforcement officer to do is when they're responding, before they arrive, think about what they need to do to assess the area. And if they can, their job is to get to the shooter. But as you mentioned before, it's a highly dangerous situation for law enforcement based on that. We know that of the 160 shootings that we investigated, 45 of them, law enforcement had to engage the shooter. And in nearly half of those situations, a law enforcement officer was either killed or wounded. That's a tremendous responsibility for law enforcement.
Absolutely. I know that the glorification of the shooter is something we want to avoid. I'd like to talk just briefly about what you think we in the media have done of late to try not to focus on the shooter per se, but we also are very curious about what went in. We're always looking why, how, you know who was involved. So tell us about how important it is for us to understand the characteristics of the shooter. And in your report, you remind us that over 50% of the time, an incident ended at a shooter's initiative. So there's this issue of whether they are really trying to commit suicide, and in the process, there's much collateral damage.
Right. Our study showed 40% of the shooters do commit suicide. And so when you think about whether or not that's what their intent is. And everybody wants to know why. And why did this happen? It's understandable that everybody wants to know why. But from a media standpoint, and I say this as a person who has a bachelor's degree in journalism and works as a journalist, journalists have to be patient and not speculate and not let the neighbors speculate. Sometimes people just have to know and have to have a reason. But as we all know, it takes time to collect the real information. As a whole, as a society, we have to be patient and let the evidence come together. I will say that one of the things that I'm very pleased with, and particularly this has been since pretty much the time of the Sandy Hook shooting, we worked frantically in Washington, working with national media, and I think that local media absolutely followed suit to make sure that the shooters are not identified. There isn't any reason for anybody to stand up and talk about a shooter by name, even if we have to give some characteristics. An 18-year-old who attended the school, the local people know who the shooter is. Doesn't have to hear it for a national news audience.
You know that America is getting very impatient with these incidents and worried, as you earlier suggested. And we want predictive capabilities. We want to make certain that we're doing everything we can to forestall this activity. And yet we're told that domestic acts of terror and these active shooter situations are different, perhaps, than what we might be able to do with those who are from outside of the country, which was our focus for a long period of time. What do you think, from a domestic standpoint, the public should expect? Because we don't want to take away civil liberties. We do know a lot more because social media seems to be sharing a lot of information, and we're getting a lot of reads on individuals who have a lot of grievances. So where do we take all of that?
Well, make no mistake, the domestic and international investigations with regard to terrorism have always been at the top of the FBI's list, and it will continue to be that way. But with regard to the domestic terrorism and the concern about the frustration with, hey, how can we do that? I know there's been discussion lately about whether or not there should be a domestic terrorism statute, and I worked at domestic terrorist cases in the FBI where I worked. We don't have a domestic terrorism statute, so my subjects went to jail over gun violations and hate crimes violations, as they do. So we can work the cases. A statute might be different, but I think that it might give us an additional statutory tool to use. But I think you raised the exact concern that all of us have, that we are very protective of our own civil rights, our own rights under the Constitution. To me, the 45 words in the First Amendment are some of the most important words I have ever read, and we abide by those. And it's just as important for the FBI. When I took an oath to be an FBI agent, I took an oath to ensure that I protected all the rights under the Constitution. So it is quite a challenge, and you do have to have predication. That's the trick from an investigator standpoint. Don't investigate what somebody believes in and thinks, investigate what they do. So that's what we need to continue to focus on, is that even if there is a statute, it has to be based on what is somebody doing that potentially could cause harm.
I was just reading where roughly 80% of the FBI's counterterrorism agents are focused on foreign ideologies like Islamic extremism, and that includes agents investigating homegrown jihadists. What is the pressure going to be? I mean, the tolerance for what has been happening in America, particularly the carnage in Texas and Ohio of late, really has brought this issue center stage. So do you think there's going to be a reemphasis within the FBI?
I don't mean to speak for the FBI, of course, but, you know, the FBI has never set aside a concern about domestic terrorism at the expense of anything. I mean, those are legitimate concerns, and the FBI investigates whatever comes to it. So we ebb and flow. So the FBI ebbs and flows as an organization, depending on the type of cases that comes to it based on the facts they get. I recognize, and I can hear the frustration maybe in your voice and other people's voices about what can we do about these cases that are homegrown. But we have had homegrown cases for years, and we will continue to have them. And the FBI is going to just have to continue to work them.
Catherine, in closing, is there anything about your study that we didn't raise today that you think people should understand and might give us even further insights into the issue of active shooters?
I would want to encourage listeners to appreciate that the most important thing they can do is see something and say something. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States, 800,000 law enforcement officers, 15,000 FBI agents. There are millions of people in the United States, and it is peers, family members, and friends who are going to see something, and they have to say something, or we will not solve this problem.
Catherine, I thank you so much for being with us today. A really tough topic. You certainly have handled it most expertly today. If people want to get a hold of the active shooter study that was done by you for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, how can they do that?
They can actually search FBI active shooter resources, and they'll get a page on in the FBI's website that'll have all the statistics, the study, and all the current research that's been done. So FBI active shooter resources.
All right. Thanks again for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.